Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Tales to Terrify, part of the District of Wonders network. Featuring Starship Sofa and Far-Fetched Fables, everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
Good evening, children of the night. Tonight, I think that we will open our show with a story that our own Seth Williams, who will also be reading a story for you tonight in the next 2 weeks. It's a special story that, well, I'll just let Seth speak first.
Good evening, children of the night. I'm happy to be here to share a quick story with you. Now, this isn't our normal fare of the terrible and the terrifying, but a story about how we as a community come together in ways that we might not be aware of. I was spending time at my local Comic-Con, checking out the booths and chatting with some local writers. It came up that I worked for Tales to Terrify, and one of the gentlemen turned and thanked me. I, of course, responded that it was my pleasure, and he went on to explain that he had lost his daughter 2 or 3 years ago. It was a very difficult time for him, and he stated that Tales gave him something to listen to keep him occupied, and he didn't feel like he needed to think happy thoughts. Well, I was overwhelmed. I expressed my condolences, after which he expressed his for our loss of our founding host, Larry. We were two people who had never met, in a conference center with 30,000 attendees, and made a connection based on the sharing of stories. So to every one of you, welcome. Thank you. And please, keep sharing your stories with us.
Thank you for sharing that, Seth. One of the things that keeps me going on this project that we call Tales to Terrify are stories like this. Typically, for me, they come in through our Gmail address and not in person. But Seth shared this encounter with the staff, and we found it moving. I have spoken at length about our shared love of this strange genre that asks us to explore the inescapable and inevitability of the worst parts of this strange existence. To our unnamed listener, I can only imagine the pain of the loss of a child. I have not and do not expect to fully understand your pain. I am happy that our creative endeavor helped you shoulder that pain, and you sharing your story with us validates our labor. Very recently, my wife and I made the decision to euthanize her cat. The animal was more than a decade and a half old and was having difficulty breathing. Truly a sad day for the both of us, but my wife had had that cat in her life longer than she knew me. It was much harder for her, and in my efforts to comfort her, I never once tried to ask her to cheer up, to be happy, or to get over it. Quite the opposite. I encouraged her to be sad, cry, and mourn as much as she felt she needed to. I, nor any of the Tales of Terrify staff, pretend to be grief counselors, but we would have all meditated on the unavoidable event that defines what it is to be mortal, and the pain that is inflicted on those who catch the emotional shrapnel from the same event, shaking our understanding of our own existence. My point in all of this is that I'm happy to know that Tales of Terrify helped, in a very specific way, at least to one listener. And for everyone that has suffered a loss, take comfort in anything that you can. And if you can't find that comfort on your own, the world is populated with professionals who can help you. Difficult times are a promise in life. Many you can shoulder on your own, regardless if you want to or not. But some, no one can be expected to carry on their own. There is an unusual book by Caitlin Dowdy called Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory, in which she writes, "Accepting death doesn't mean you won't be devastated when someone you love dies. It means you will be able to focus on your grief, unburdened by bigger existential questions like, why do people die? And why is this happening to me? Death isn't happening to you. Death is happening to us all. Children of the Night, we are all in this thing together. But now, on to our stories. Our first story of the night comes from Jeremy McGargy. Jeremy McGargy has always loved dark fiction. He cut his teeth on R.L. Stine's Goosebumps series as a child, and a fascination with Stephen King's work followed later in life. Jeremy weaves his tales of personal horror from Martinsburg, West Virginia, with his cat, Lazarus, acting as his muse/familiar. Listen with me to Jeremy A. McGargy's Doll Eater.
Doll Eater by Jeremy McGargy, read by Jake Wackles. The eater studies the little charred baby doll head, his plump fingers brushing against glassy eyes and smooth plastic cheeks. It's partially melted, one side of the face a pinkish ruin, but the eater doesn't mind. It makes for a unique dish, a baked delight. Just one of many he scavenged from the local dump. He has his favorite places for procuring his secret nourishment. Salvage yards, thrift shops, toy store dumpsters. He's gotten good at sniffing them out. These delectable doll parts, these tiny lumpy limbs that crowd together in the snaky hollows of his intestines. He tastes the entire life of the doll when he takes them into himself. Their time spent on the manufacturing line in the factory, hours locked away in cupboard boxes. Those moments where they're loved and appreciated. And even the dark, lonely times where they live out their endless, immortal days in attics and basements. The eater is a mercy to these broken creatures, these lifeless little dolls made of lasting plastic, their tortured forms sometimes languishing for centuries before breaking down. He touches them when no one else will. He slurps down their plastic parts with gluttonous glee, his piggish eyes sunken back into deep hollows. He has eaten legions of dolls in his time. His voracious appetite will never be satisfied until the doorway to the doll realm opens to him. The eater does not live as others do. He ceased to exist in the normal flow of humanity long ago. His existence is solitary and misunderstood. A corpulent hobo draped in sour, colorless rags with a vacant expression always dominating his face. He had a family once, a wife, a home, and all those things that being a functioning member of society provides. He cannot recall what happened to separate him from those things. Doesn't matter. Unimportant and trivial. He is built for more than that. His kingdom beneath the underpass is a lonesome place, but here he is free to rule, and only the eyes of dolls watch him. The unseeing eyes of the dolls never cast judgment upon him. They do not laugh at the bubbling saliva that collects in the corners of his mouth, or the desperate mewling sound he makes when the big 18-wheelers blaze by above his head. His rusty cart is full of nothing but broken doll carcasses. Little arms, twisted legs, and dirty hands reaching towards light that is always denied. Food for the king. Sustenance for the eater. He cradles the parts in his palms before he dines, rocking himself back and forth on the mud throne, seeking solace and purpose in the severed limb with the stubby plastic fingers. The eater is a sensitive man. He feels things so deeply. The rain smashing into the soil, the wind howling through the winter branches, the hard surface of doll anatomy that he's about to consume. A feast to get him closer to the door. He's not sure what waits on the other side of the door. He glimpsed his first view of the doll realm when he chewed a tiny doll foot to pieces between his rotting tombstone teeth many years ago. It came to him in wispy fragments, a world beyond this world, a place where dolls walk across quiet stretches of space and time. They did not speak to him in his vision, but the glassy eyes implored, "Devour us. Take us inside. Let us in, and we'll open the door from within." And so he has. His health has spiraled down. His weight has ballooned unnaturally, and he has ceased to produce anything but the smallest amounts of fecal matter. His skin is jaundiced, and his eyes forever bloodshot. Nothing but shiny silver dollars in the folds of flab that comprise his moon face. A superficial price to pay for his obsession. This life is a story that makes no sense anymore. There are entire pages missing, chapters written backwards, and a plot that never changes. He wants a new story. And through the dolls, he will have it. The eater hums to himself, swaddled in decaying layers of clothing, his stench drawing a few curious insects up from the dirt to explore his gargantuan body. He doesn't notice. A cracked tongue protrudes, slippery and seeking, and soon the doll arm is sliding slowly down his gullet, his chest heaving with effort to make sure that the treat makes it into his lower abdomen like a slithering plastic worm. Bliss. Closer to the key, and how the doll realm sings to him. They stand above the eater, like monolithic mannequins, a pair of enormous dolls, their bodies nude and genderless, faces decorated in grime with giant dead eyes staring down at him. Constellations circle behind them, god dolls to the eater, these celestial plastic people that favor him with empty love. He is humbled before them. He drops to his knees, tears shining in his eyes, his filthy hands clamping together in a beggar's prayer. He feels tiny hands and feet pressing against his stomach from within. The ones inside. The parts that let him see what lies outside of this universe. These great, towering things that rule in the void. Their appendages creak as an arm the size of a tree limb rises, the cold hand falling upon his shoulder. They speak not a word, but the doll parts inside of him scrawl out the letters of their message on the insides of his soft organs. Chosen, accepted, invited, eat of us and come forever. Come where the dolls stare eternal with their dead eyes. Disconnect yourself from that doomed world you call home and drift here in the timeless place of plastic. Hunger burns, and it will show you the way. Whispers from his gut. The voracious need returns. The eater's work is not yet done. He awakens in a pool of his own bile. He's twitching, muscle spasms passing through his entire mammoth body. Each time he is granted a vision of the doll realm, he comes back lessened. Bits and pieces of his mind remain there, leaving only dusty corridors and blank holes in his thoughts. The doll parts sit heavily in his belly, one hand reaching down to massage them beneath the flesh. The parts seem agitated, eager to fully transition into doll realm existence. The eater knows what's expected of him now. The god dolls showed him a spot in a little patch of shrubby wilderness outside of the city. There's a long-forgotten doll there, a half-buried treasure with little springs of black hair and a colony of ants living in her cratered chest. She is called Mallory, and she is the final key. She is the feast that opens the door to the doll realm forever, and the eater need only find her and taste her to fulfill his destiny. He pushes against the dirt, lifting up his blubbery frame until he reaches his full height. He steps out from beneath the underpass, full dark now, the headlights from above cutting through the rain to shine upon his pock-marked face. The eater must go walking. The eater must hunt. The eater must dine on dark delights, and only then will he be permitted to ascend. The eater slouches through crooked streets, his cart rattling with discarded doll limbs. He hunches over it, a man with a burden. But the burden will lead to a favorable end. He gapes at the cars and trucks that pass him, occasional pedestrians leering at him with sneers and upturned noses. They do not understand. They fail to recognize his great purpose. Beneath the foulness and sorrow of his lumbering life, there is a truly selfless man. He eats so that others do not have to eat. He knows that opening the doorway may be his undoing, but he accepts this fate without question. His is the doll realm, and perhaps he'll find peace there. This wretched body he inhabits will cease to matter in that vast nothingness, and the genderless lords will look upon him as a dutiful servant. He can almost feel the icy touch of a cold plastic hand cupping his cheek. It makes him think of his childhood. He had dolls even then. They stood on his bookshelves and watched him sleep. He loved them, every part of them. And it was his love that drove him to dismember them, burn them, and decapitate them. He sought to become closer with his voiceless friends, to hear just the smallest note of suffering from those painted cherub mouths. He never did. They never spoke to him, never comforted him, and this was a cruelty. He'd slobber on their faces with murky kisses and scratch at their eyes with his fingernails, but his interest was never reciprocated. Such fickle creatures, these dolls. A terrible indifference to them. The eater has known so much indifference in his life. and it is arguably the worst feeling of all. A hole of apathy takes shape in the heart, and you must fill it with something. The eater's bottomless heart pit is full to the brim with dead, devoured dolls. And now their faces are bound to him. They must love the body that carries them. They are forced to love the eater. And all the wet, sticky chambers inside of him. A home for dolls. A great, internal orphanage for abandoned babies that will never be played with again. His hand reaches down to absently rub against his stomach and all the entities that now live beneath the flesh. His dirty dolls. His silent companions. Surely, they want him to succeed and ascend. He sits on a hill of moss, the canopy of trees above allowing not even a single ray of dim sunlight to fall upon him. The eater coos to himself, his fingers carefully digging at the moss, unearthing the remnants of the one called Mallory. Her head reaches out of the soil, almost like she's seeking rescue. But the eater is not a gallant knight come to offer her solace. He is a practical fellow with a hunger that burns, and all that waits for the freshly freed Mallory are the flames that line his gut. He plucks little specks of moss from her face, taking just a moment to scrub his thumb across her thinning black hair. Then he crams her entire form into his gaping maw, chewing like a beast, the sounds emerging from his throat, both animalistic and pitiful. Soon she is gone, sliding through him, and the world winks out. His girth hits the moss, and his mind flies past unnameable stars. He comes back to himself beneath the god dolls. They're gesturing to him, beckoning, but he is immobile. He realizes he is mistaken. They are not beckoning to him. They are beckoning to all that the eater has eaten. He feels a terrible constricting sensation in the lower depths of his stomach. Tiny hands and feet press outward, teasing his flesh. And soon, his lower half bursts open like spoiled meat, chunky portions of blood and ruin falling out to stain his boots. Something heavy falls out of the aperture of his abdomen, a shivering, crawling thing that fights to free itself from his tangled intestines. The eater tries to clamp trembling hands to the crater-sized wound, but it's no use. The foulness seeping steadily through his intertwined fingers. Horror alights in his eyes. He gazes on the crawling abomination that is moving toward him. It resembles a spider made from multiple dismembered doll parts. A hideous automation of plastic arms, limbs, and many bulging heads. It scuttles towards him. The movements are like that of a crab. Tiny plastic hands struggling to gain purchase in the sea of meaty plasma. It stares at the eater with a thousand glassy doll eyes. The god dolls watch from above. Proud parents, their apathetic features locked on the newly birthed creation. The eater can barely stand. Strings of slobbery bile dripping past his lips. The many-legged ball of dolls dances in the rainfall, little plastic hands clapping with glee. It stops suddenly, staring up at the eater. A thin line appears across the center of the thing, and a mouth stretches open. Sharp plastic teeth grinning in the void. Several dripping tongues emerge, licking at unfeeling lips. The eater sees his face written across those tongues. How fitting. The eater becomes the eaten. That is his only place here in the Dal realm. A birthing vessel. Sustenance for the thing that grew and shaped itself inside of him. Suddenly, he doesn't feel so lonesome anymore. He made this beautiful aberration. It beams at him with so much empty love.
Mother!
The voice of the many-legged ball of Dals is akin to a blade puncturing both of his eardrums. Human ears are not meant for it. His thoughts are sliced into clean ribbons in the wake of that word.
Thank you.
And then the thing is upon him, licking, pawing, gnawing, and chewing. A raw Dal intent on having it all. He lets it happen. He does not care. His sacrifice. His legacy. A host for Dals. One of the last of the Eater tribes. Selfless be their burden. All that he was is smeared across the lost constellations of the Dal realm. He is eaten slowly, an intimate meal. No one there to watch, but glassy Dal eyes. And what do Dal eyes really see?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
That was Jeremy A. McGargy's Dal Eater, as read by Jake Walkholtz. Jake Walkholtz has finally found his career path in education and completed his first year of teaching this past year, where he taught special education math. His hobby is hobbies, and now that includes reading horror stories for Tales to Terrify. He lives in Ohio with his wife, daughter, and dog Tur. Thank you, Jake. And now, something special. We have for you Franz Kafka's The Metamorphosis, as translated by David Wiley for you. Fans of the story will know this is a bit of a lengthy one, but it is naturally serialized into three parts, and tonight you will be hearing the first of those three. Franz Kafka, born in 1883, was a German language novelist and short story writer, widely regarded as one of the major figures of 20th century literature. His work, which fuses elements of realism and the fantastic, typically feature isolated protagonists faced by bizarre or surrealistic predicaments and incomprehensible social bureaucratic powers, and has been interpreted as exploring themes of alienation, existential anxiety, guilt, and absurdity. His best-known works include The Metamorphosis, The Trial, and The Castle. The term Kafkaesque has entered the English language to describe situations like those in his writing. Kafka died in 1924. Give me your ears for the first part of Franz Kafka's The Metamorphosis.
One morning, when Gregor Samsa woke from troubled dreams, he found himself transformed in his bed into a horrible vermin. He lay on his armor-like back, and if he lifted his head a little, he could see his brown belly, slightly domed and divided by arches into stiff sections. The bedding was hardly able to cover it, and it seemed ready to slide off at any moment. His many legs, pitifully thin compared with the size of the rest of him, waved about helplessly as he looked. "What's happened to me?" he thought. It wasn't a dream. His room, a proper human room, although a little too small, lay peacefully between its four familiar walls. A collection of textile samples lay spread out on the table. Samsa was a traveling salesman, and above it, there hung a picture that he had recently cut out of an illustrated magazine and housed it in a nice gilded frame. It showed a lady fitted out with a fur hat and fur boa, who sat upright, raising a heavy fur muff that covered the whole of her lower arm towards the viewer. Gregor then turned to look out the window at the dull weather. Drops of rain could be heard hitting the pane, which made him feel quite sad. "How about if I sleep a little longer and forget all this nonsense?" he thought. But that was something he was unable to do, because he was used to sleeping on his right, and in his present state, couldn't get into that position. However hard he threw himself onto his right, he always rolled back to where he was. He must have tried it 100 times, shut his eyes so that he wouldn't have to look at the floundering legs, and only stopped when he began to feel a mild, dull pain there that he had never felt before. "Oh, God," he thought. "What a strenuous career it is that I've chosen. Traveling day in and day out. Doing business like this takes much more effort than doing your own business at home. And on top of that, there's the curse of traveling. Worries about making train connections, bad and irregular food, contact with different people all the time so that you can never get to know anyone or become friendly with them. It can all go to hell." He felt a slight itch up on his belly, pushed himself slowly up on his back towards the headboard so that he could lift his head better. He found where the itch was, and saw that it was covered with lots of little white spots which he didn't know what to make of. And when he tried to feel the place with one of his legs, he drew it quickly back because, as soon as he touched it, he was overcome by a cold shudder. He slid back into his former position. "Getting up early all the time," he thought, "it makes you stupid. You've got to get enough sleep. Other traveling salesmen live in a life of luxury. For instance, whenever I go back to the guest house during the morning to copy out the contract, these gentlemen are always still sitting there eating their breakfasts. I ought to just try that with my boss. I'd get kicked out on the spot. But who knows? Maybe that would be the best thing for me. If I didn't have my parents to think about, I'd have given my notice a long time ago. I'd have gone up to the boss and told him just what I think, tell him everything I would, let him know just what I feel. He'd fall right off his desk. And it's a funny sort of business to be sitting up there at your desk, talking down at your subordinates from up there, especially when you have to go right up close because the boss is hard of hearing. Well, there's still some hope. Once I've got the money together to pay off my parents' debt to him, another 5 or 6 years, I suppose, that's definitely what I'll do. That's when I'll make the big change. First of all, though, I've got to get up. My train leaves at 5. And then he looked over at the alarm clock, ticking on the chest of drawers. "God in heaven," he thought. It was 6:30, and the hands were quietly moving forwards. It was even later than 7:30, more like 6:45. Had the alarm clock not rung? He could see from the bed that it had been set for 4:00, as it should have been. It certainly must have rung. Yes. But was it possible to quietly sleep through the furniture rattling noise? True, he had not slept peacefully, but probably all the more deeply because of that. What should he do now? The next train went at 7. If he were to catch that, he would have to rush like mad, and the collection of samples was still not packed, and he did not feel at all particularly fresh and lively. And even if he did catch the train, he would not avoid his boss's anger, as the office assistant would have been there to see the 5:00 train go. He would have put in his report about Gregor's not being there a long time ago. The office assistant was the boss's man, spineless and with no understanding. What about if he reported sick? But that would be extremely strained and suspicious, as in 15 years of service, Gregor had never once yet been ill. His boss would certainly come round with the doctor from the medical insurance company, accuse his parents of having a lazy son, and accept the doctor's recommendation not to make a claim, as the doctor believed that no one was ever ill, but that many were work-shy. And what's more, would he have been entirely wrong in this case? Gregor did, in fact, apart from excessive sleepiness after sleeping for so long, feel completely well and even felt much hungrier than usual. He was still hurriedly thinking all this through, unable to decide to get out of bed, when the clock struck 6:45. There was a cautious knock at the door near his head. "Gregor," someone called. It was his mother. "It's 6:45. Didn't you want to go somewhere?" That gentle voice. Gregor was shocked when he heard his own voice answering it, if it could be recognized as the voice he had before. As if from deep inside him, there was a painful and uncontrollable squeaking mixed in with it. The words could be made out at first, but then there was a sort of echo which made them unclear, leaving the hearer unsure whether he had heard properly or not. Gregor had wanted to give a full answer and explain everything, but in the circumstances contented himself with saying, "Yes, Mother. Yes, thank you. I'm getting up now." The change in Gregor's voice probably could not be noticed outside through the wooden door, as his mother was satisfied with his explanation and shuffled away. But this short conversation made the other members of the family aware that Gregor, against their expectations, was still at home, and soon his father came knocking at one of the side doors, gently, but with his fist. "Gregor," he called, "what's wrong?" And after a short while, he called again with a warning deepness in his voice. "Gregor! Gregor!" At the other side door, his sister came plaintively.
"Gregor, aren't you well? Do you need anything?"
Gregor answered to both sides, "I'm ready now," making an effort to remove all the strangeness from his voice by enunciating very carefully and putting long pauses between each individual word. His father went back to his breakfast, but his sister whispered,
"Gregor, open the door, I beg you."
Gregor, however, had no thought of opening the door, and instead congratulated himself for his cautious habit, acquired from his traveling, of locking all doors at night even when he was at home. The first thing he wanted to do was to get up in peace without being disturbed, to get dressed, and most of all, to have his breakfast. Only then would he consider what to do next, as he was well aware that he would not bring his thoughts to any sensible conclusion by lying in bed. He remembered that he had often felt a slight pain in bed, perhaps caused by lying awkwardly, but that had always turned out to be pure imagination, and he wondered how his imaginings would slowly resolve themselves today. He did not have the slightest doubt that the change in his voice was nothing more than the first signs of a serious cold, which was an occupational hazard for traveling salesmen. It was a simple matter to throw off the covers. He only had to blow himself up a little, and they fell off by themselves. But it became difficult after that, especially as he was so exceptionally broad. He would have used his arms and hands to push himself up,
But instead of them, he only had all those little tiny legs continuously moving in different directions, in which he was, moreover, unable to control. If he wanted to bend one of them, then that was the first one that would stretch itself out. And if he finally managed to do what he wanted with that leg, all the others seemed to be set free and would move about painfully. "This is something that can't be done in bed," Gregor said to himself. "So don't keep trying to do it." The first thing he wanted to do was to get the lower part of his body out of bed, but he had never seen the lower part and could not imagine what it looked like. It turned out to be too hard to move. It went so slowly, and finally, almost in a frenzy, when he carelessly shoved himself forward with all the force he could gather, he chose the wrong direction, hit hard against the lower bedpost, and learned from the burning pain he felt that the lower part of his body might well, at present, be the most sensitive. So then he tried to get the top part of his body out of the bed first, carefully turning his head to the side. This he managed quite easily, and despite its breadth and its width, the bulk of his body eventually followed slowly in the direction of the head. But when he had at last got his head out of the bed and into the fresh air, it occurred to him that if he let himself fall, it would be a miracle if his head were not injured. So he became afraid to carry on, pushing himself forward the same way. And he could not knock himself out now at any price. Better to stay in bed than to lose consciousness. It took just as much effort to get back to where he had been earlier, but when he lay there sighing, and was once more watching his legs as they struggled against each other even harder than before, if that were possible, he could think of no way to bring peace and order to this chaos. He told himself once more that it was not possible for him to stay in bed, and that the most sensible thing to do would be to get free of it in whatever way he could, at whatever sacrifice. At the same time, though, he did not forget to remind himself that calm consideration was much better than rushing to desperate conclusions. At times like this, he would direct his eyes to the window and look out as clearly as he could. But unfortunately, even the other side of the narrow street was enveloped in morning fog, and the view had little confidence or cheer to offer him. 7 o'clock already, he said to himself when the clock struck again. 7 o'clock, and there's still a fog like this. And he lay there quite a while longer, breathing lightly, as perhaps he expected the total stillness to bring things back to their real and natural state. But then he said to himself, "Before it strikes 7:15, I'll definitely have to get properly out of bed. And by then, someone will have come round from work to ask what's happened to me as well, as they open up for work before 7 o'clock. And so he set himself to the task of swinging the entire length of his body out of the bed all at the same time. If he succeeded in falling out of bed in this way and kept his head raised as he did so, he could probably avoid injuring it. His back seemed to be quite hard, and probably nothing would happen to it falling onto the carpet. His main concern was for the loud noise he was bound to make, and which even through all the doors would probably raise concern, if not alarm. But it was something that had to be risked. When Gregor was already sticking halfway out of the bed, the new method was more of a game than an effort. All he had to do was rock back and forth. It occurred to him how simple everything would be if somebody came in to help him. Two strong people, and he had his father and the maid in mind, would have been more than enough. They would only have to push their arms under the dome of his back, peel him away from the bed, bend down with the load, and then be patient and careful as he swung over onto the floor, where, hopefully, the little legs would find a use. Should he really call for help, though, even apart from the fact that all the doors were locked? Despite all the difficulty he was in, he could not suppress a smile at this thought. After a while, he had already moved so far across that it would have been hard for him to keep his balance if he rocked too hard. The time was now 7:10, and he would have to make a final decision very soon. Then there was a ring at the door of the flat. That had to be someone from work, he said to himself, and froze still. although his little legs only became all the more lively as they danced around. For a moment, everything remained quiet. "They're not opening the door," Gregor said to himself, caught in some nonsensical hope. But then, of course, the maid's firm steps went to the door and, as ever, opened it. Gregor only needed to hear his visitor's first words of greeting, and he knew who it was, the chief clerk himself. Why did Gregor have to be the only one condemned to work for a company, where they immediately became highly suspicious at the slightest shortcoming? Were all the employees, every one of them, louts? Was there not one of them who was faithful and devoted, who would go so mad with pangs of conscience that he couldn't get out of bed if he didn't spend at least a couple of hours in the morning on company business? Was it really not enough to let one of the trainees make inquiries, assuming inquiries were even necessary? Did the chief clerk have to come himself, and did they have to show the whole innocent family that this was so suspicious that only the chief clerk could be trusted to have the wisdom to investigate it? And more because these thoughts made him upset than through any proper decision, he swung himself with all his force out of the bed. There was a loud lump, but it wasn't really a loud noise. His fall was softened a little by the carpet, and Gregor's back was also more elastic than he had thought, which made the sound muffled and not too noticeable. He had not held his head carefully enough, though, and it hit as he fell. Annoyed and in pain, he turned it and rubbed it against the carpet. "Something's fallen down in there," said the chief clerk in the room on the left. Gregor tried to imagine whether something of the sort that had happened to him today could ever happen to the chief clerk, too. He had to concede it was possible. But as if in gruff reply to his question, the chief clerk's firm footsteps in his highly polished boots could now be heard in the adjoining room. From the room on his right, Gregor's sister whispered to him to let him know.
"Gregor, the chief clerk is here."
"Yes, I know," said Gregor to himself, but without daring to raise his voice loud enough for his sister to hear him. "Gregor," said his father now from the room on his left, "the chief clerk has come round and wants to know why you didn't leave on the early train. We don't know what to say to him. And anyway, he wants to speak to you personally. So please, open up this door. I'm sure he'll be good enough to forgive the untidiness of your room." Then the chief clerk called. "Good morning, Mr. Samsa." "He isn't well," his mother to the chief clerk, while his father continued to speak through the door. "He isn't well, please believe me. Why else would Gregor have missed the train? The lad only ever thinks about business, and nearly makes me cross the way he never goes out in the evenings. He's been in town for a week now, but stayed home every evening. He sits with us in the kitchen and just reads the paper or studies train timetables. His idea of relaxation is working with his fret saw. He made a little frame, for instance. It only took him 2 or 3 evenings. You'll be amazed how nice it is. It's hanging up in his room. You'll see it as soon as Gregor opens the door. Anyway, I'm glad you're here. We wouldn't have been able to get Gregor to open the door by ourselves. He's so stubborn. And I'm sure he isn't well. He said this morning that he is, but he isn't."
"I'll be there in a moment," said Gregor slowly and thoughtfully, but without moving so that he would not miss any word of the conversation.
"Well, I can't think of any other way of explaining it, Mrs. Samsa," said the chief clerk. "I hope it's nothing serious. But on the other hand, I must say that if we people in commerce ever become slightly unwell, then, fortunately or unfortunately, as you like, we simply have to overcome it because of business considerations."
"Can the chief clerk come and see you now, then?" asked his father impatiently, knocking at the door.
"No," said Gregor. In the room on his right there followed a painful silence. In the room on his left, his sister began to cry. So why did his sister not go and join the others? She was probably only just got up and had not even begun to get dressed. And why was she crying? Was it because he had not got up and he had not let the chief clerk in? Because he was in danger of losing his job, and if that happened, his boss would once more pursue their parents with the same demands as before?
There was no need to worry about things like that yet. Gregor was still there and had not the slightest intention of abandoning his family. For the time being, he just lay there on the carpet, and no one who knew the condition he was in would seriously have expected him to let the chief clerk in. It was only a minor discourtesy, and a suitable excuse could be easily found for it later on. It was not something for which Gregor could be sacked on the spot. And it seemed to Gregor much more sensible to leave him now in peace instead of disturbing him with talking at him and crying. But the others didn't know what was happening. They were worried. That would excuse their behavior. The chief clerk now raised his voice. "Mr. Samsa," he called to him, "what is wrong? You barricade yourself in your room. Give us no more than yes or no for answer. You are causing serious and unnecessary concern to your parents, and you fail, and I mention this just by the way, you fail to carry out your business duties in a way that is quite unheard of. I'm speaking here on behalf of your parents and of your employer, and really must request a clear and immediate explanation. I am astonished, quite astonished. I thought I knew you as a calm and sensible person, and now you suddenly seem to be showing off with particular whims. This morning, your employer did suggest a possible reason for your failure to appear. It's true. It had to do with the money that was recently entrusted to you. But I came near to giving him my word of honor that could not be the right explanation. But now I see that your incomprehensible stubbornness, I no longer feel any wish whatsoever to intercede on your behalf. And nor is your position all that secure. I had originally intended to say all of this in private, but since you caused me to waste my time here for no good reason, I don't see why your parents should not learn it also. Your turnover has been very unsatisfactory of late. I grant you that it's not the time of year to do especially good in business. We recognize that. But there simply is no time of year to do no business at all, Mr. Samsa. We cannot allow there to be." "But, sir," Gregor called, beside himself and forgetting all else in the excitement, "I'll open up immediately. Just a moment. I'm slightly unwell. An attack of dizziness. I haven't been able to get up. I'm still in bed now. I'm quite fresh again now, though. I'm just getting out of bed. Just a moment. Be patient. It's not quite as easy as I thought. I'm quite all right now, though. It's shocking what can happen to a person. I was quite all right last night. My parents know about it, perhaps better than me. I had a small symptom of it last night already. They must have noticed it. I don't know why I didn't let you know at work, but you always think you can get over an illness without staying at home. Please, don't make my parents suffer. There's no basis for any of the accusations you're making. No one's ever said a word to me about any of these things. Maybe you haven't read the latest contracts I sent in. I'll set off with the 8 o'clock train as well. These few hours of rest have given me strength. You don't need to wait, sir. I'll be in the office soon after you, and please be so good as to tell that to the boss and recommend me to him." And while Gregor gushed out these words, hardly knowing what he was saying, he made his way over to the chest of drawers. This was easily done, probably because of the practice he had already had in bed, where he now tried to get himself upright. He really did want to open the door, really did want to let them see him and to speak with the chief clerk. The others were being so insistent, and he was curious to learn what they would say when they caught sight of him. If they were shocked, then it would be no longer Gregor's responsibility, and he could rest. If, however, they took everything calmly, he would still have no reason to be upset, and if he hurried, he could really be at the station for the 8 o'clock. The first few times he tried to climb up the smooth chest of drawers, he just slid down again. But he finally gave himself one last swing and stood there, upright. The lower part of his body was in serious pain, but he no longer gave any attention to it. Now he let himself fall against the back of a nearby chair and held tightly to the edges of it with his little legs. By now, he had also calmed down and kept quiet so that he could listen to what the chief clerk was saying.
"Did you understand a word of all that?" the chief clerk asked his parents. "Surely he's not trying to make a fool of us."
"Oh,
God, called his mother, who was already in tears. He could be seriously ill and we're making him suffer. Greta! Greta! She then cried. Mother? His sister called from the other side. They communicated across Gregor's room. You'll have to go for the doctor straight away. Gregor is ill. Quick, get the doctor. Did you hear the way Gregor spoke just now?
That was the voice of an animal, said the chief clerk, with a calmness that was in contrast to his mother's screams. Anna! Anna! His father called into the kitchen through the entrance hall, clapping his hands. Get a locksmith here, now! And the two girls, their skirts swishing, immediately ran out through the hall, wrenching open the front door of the flat as they went. How had his sister managed to get dressed so quickly? There was no sound of the door banging shut again. They must have left it open. People often do in homes where something awful has happened. Gregor, in contrast, had become much calmer. So they couldn't understand his words anymore. Although they seemed clear enough to him, clearer than before. Perhaps his ears had become used to the sound. They had realized, though, that there was something wrong with him, and were ready to help. The first response to his situation had been confident and wise, and that made him feel much better. He felt that he had been drawn back in amongst people, and from the doctor and the locksmith, he expected great and surprising achievements, although he did not really distinguish one from the other. Whatever was said next would be crucial, so, in order to make his voice as clear as possible, he coughed a little, but taking care not to do this loudly, as even this might sound different from the way a human coughs, and he was no longer sure he could judge this for himself. Meanwhile, it had become very quiet in the next room. Perhaps his parents were sat at the table whispering with the chief clerk, or perhaps they were all pressed against the door and listening. Gregor slowly pushed his way over to the door with the chair. Once there, he let go of it and threw himself onto the door, holding himself upright against it, using the adhesive on the tips of his legs. He rested there a little while to recover from the effort involved, and then set himself to the task of turning the key in the lock with his mouth. He seemed, unfortunately, to have no proper teeth. How was he then to grasp the key? But the lack of teeth was, of course, made up for by a very strong jaw. Using the jaw, he really was able to start the key turning. Ignoring the fact that he must have been causing some kind of damage as brown fluid came from his mouth, flowed over the key and dripped into the floor. Listen, said the chief clerk in the next room. He's turning the key. Gregor was greatly encouraged by this. But they all should have been calling to him, his father and his mother too. Well done, Gregor. They should have cried, keep at it, keep hold of the lock. And with the idea that they were all excitedly following his efforts, he bit on the key with all his strength, paying no attention to the pain he was causing himself. As the key turned round, he turned around the lock with it, only holding himself upright with his mouth, and hung on to the key, or pushed it down against with the whole weight of his body as needed. The clear sound of the lock as it snapped back was Gregor's sign that he could break his concentration, and as he regained his breath, he said to himself, "So, I didn't need the locksmith after all." Then he lay his head on the handle of the door to open it completely. Because he had to open the door in this way, it was already wide open before he could be seen. He had first to slowly turn himself around one of the double doors, and he had to do it very carefully if he did not want to fall flat on his back before entering the room. He was still occupied with this difficult movement, unable to pay attention to anything else, when he heard the chief clerk exclaim aloud, "Oh!" which sounded like the soughing of the wind. Now he also saw him. He was the nearest to the door, his hand pressed against his open mouth and slowly retreating as if driven by a steady and invisible force. Gregor's mother, her hair still disheveled from bed despite the chief clerk's being there, looked at his father. Then she unfolded her arms, took two steps forward towards Gregor, and sank down onto the floor into her skirts that spread themselves out around her as her head disappeared down into her breast. His father looked hostile,
and clenched his fists as if wanting to knock Gregor back into his room. Then he looked uncertainly around the living room, covered his eyes with his hands, and wept so that his powerful chest shook. So Gregor did not go into the room, but leant against the inside of the other door, which was still held bolted in place. In this way, only half of his body could be seen, along with his head above it, which he leant over to one side as he peered out at the others. Meanwhile, the day had become much lighter, part of the endless gray-black building on the other side of the street, which was a hospital, could be seen quite clearly with the austere and regular line of windows piercing its facade. The rain was still falling, now throwing down large, individual droplets which hit the ground one at a time. The washing up from breakfast lay on the table. There was so much of it because, for Gregor's father, breakfast was the most important meal of the day, and he would stretch it out for several hours as he sat reading a number of different newspapers. On the wall, exactly opposite, there was a photograph of Gregor when he was a lieutenant in the army, his sword in his hand, and a carefree smile on his face as he called forth respect for his uniform and bearing. The door to the entrance hall was open, and as the front door of the flat was also open, he could see into the landing and the stairs, where they began their way down below. "Now then," said Gregor, well aware that he was the only one to have kept calm, "I'll get dressed straight away now, pack up my samples and set off. Will you please just let me leave? You can see," he said to the chief clerk, "that I am not stubborn, and I do like my job. Being a commercial traveler is arduous, but without traveling, I couldn't earn my living." "So where are you going? Into the office? Yes? Will you report everything accurately, then? Is it quite possible for someone to be temporarily unable to work? But that's just the right time to remember what's been achieved in the past and consider that later on, once the difficulty has been removed, he will certainly work with all the more diligence and concentration. You're well aware that I am seriously in debt to our employer, as well as having to look after my parents and my sister, so that I'm trapped in a difficult situation. But I will work my way out of it again. Please don't make things any harder for me than they already are, and don't take sides against me at the office. I know nobody likes the travelers. They think we earn an enormous wage as well as having a soft time of it. That's just prejudice, but they have no particular reason to think better of it. But you, sir, you have a better overview than the rest of the staff. In fact, if I can say this in confidence, a better overview than the boss himself. It's very easy for a businessman like him to make mistakes about his employees and judge them more harshly than he should. And you're also well aware that we travelers spend almost the whole year away from the office, so that we can very easily fall victim to gossip and chance and groundless complaints. And it's almost impossible to defend yourself from that sort of thing. We don't usually even hear about them. Or, if at all, it's when we arrive back home exhausted from a trip, and that's when we feel the harmful effects of what's been going on without even knowing what caused them. Please don't go away. At least first say something to show that you grant that I'm at least partially right." But the chief clerk had turned away as soon as Gregor had started to speak, and, with protruding lips, only stared back at him over his trembling shoulders as he left. He did not keep still for a moment while Gregor was speaking, but moved steadily towards the door without taking his eyes off of him. He moved very gradually, as if there had been some secret prohibition on leaving the room. It was only when he reached the entrance hall that he made a sudden movement, drew his foot from the living room, and rushed forward in a panic. In the hall, he stretched his right hand far out towards the stairway, as if out there there was some supernatural force waiting to save him. Gregor realized that it was out of the question to let the chief clerk go away in this mood if his position in the firm was not to be put in extreme danger. That was something his parents did not understand very well. Over the years, they had been convinced that his job would provide for Gregor for his entire life. And besides, they had so much to worry about at present that they had lost sight of any thought for the future. Gregor, though, did think about the future. The chief clerk had to be held back, calmed down, convinced, and finally won over. The future of Gregor and his family depended on it. If only his sister were here. She was clever. She was already in tears while Gregor was still lying peacefully on his back. And the chief clerk was a lover of women. Surely she could persuade him. She would close the front door in the entrance hall and talk him out of his shocked state. But his sister was not there. Gregor would have to do the job himself. And without considering that he still was not familiar with how well he could move about in his present state, or that his speech still might not, or probably would not, be understood, he let go of the door, pushed himself through the opening, tried to reach the chief clerk on the landing who, ridiculously, was holding to the banister with both hands. But Gregor fell immediately over, and with a little scream as he sought something to hold on to, landed on his numerous little legs. Hardly had that happened, then, for the first time that day, he began to feel all right with his body. The little legs had the solid ground under them. To his pleasure, they did exactly as he told them. They were even making the effort to carry him where he wanted to go. And he was soon believing that all his sorrow would soon be finally at an end. He held back the urge to move, but swayed from side to side as he crouched there on the floor. His mother was not far away in front of him and seemed, at first, quite engrossed in herself. But then she suddenly jumped up with her arms outstretched and her fingers spread, shouting, "Help! For pity's sake, help!" The way she held her head suggested she wanted to see Gregor better. But the unthinkable way she was hurrying backwards showed that she did not. She had forgotten that the table was behind her, with all the breakfast things on it. When she reached the table, she sat down quickly on it, without knowing what she was doing, without even seeming to notice that the coffee pot had been knocked over and a gush of coffee was pouring down onto the carpet. "Mother, mother," said Gregor gently, looking up at her. He had completely forgotten the chief clerk for the moment, but could not help himself snapping in the air with his jaws at the sight of the flow of the coffee. That set his mother screaming anew. She fled from the table and into the arms of his father as he rushed towards her. Gregor, though, had no time to spare for his parents now. The chief clerk had already reached the stairs. With his chin on the banister, he looked back for the last time. Gregor made a run for him. He wanted to be sure of reaching him. The chief clerk must have expected something, as he leapt down several stairs at once and disappeared, his shouts resounding all around the staircase. The flight of the chief clerk seemed, unfortunately, to put Gregor's father into a panic as well. Until then, he had been relatively self-controlled. But now, instead of running after the chief clerk himself, or at least not impeding Gregor as he ran after him, Gregor's father seized the chief clerk's stick in his right hand. The chief clerk had left it behind on a chair, along with his hat and his overcoat, picked up a large newspaper from the table with his left, and used them to drive Gregor back into his room, stamping his foot at him as he went. Gregor's appeals to his father were of no help. His appeals were simply not understood. However much he humbly turned his head, his father merely stamped his foot all the harder. Across the room, despite the chilly weather, Gregor's mother had pulled open a window, leant far out of it, and pressed her hands to her face. A strong draught of air flew in from the street towards the stairway. The curtains flew up. The newspapers on the table fluttered, and some of them were blown onto the floor. Nothing would stop Gregor's father as he drove him back, making hissing noises at him like a wild man. Gregor had never any practice in moving backwards, and was only able to go very slowly. If Gregor had only been allowed to turn round, he would have been back in his room straight away. But he was afraid that, if he took the time to do that, his father would become impatient, and there was the threat of a lethal blow to the back of his head from the stick in his father's hand at any moment. Eventually, though, Gregor realized that he had no choice as he saw, to his disgust, that he was quite incapable of going backwards in a straight line. So he began, as quickly as possible, and with frequent anxious glances at his father, to turn himself around. It went very slowly, but perhaps his father was able to see his good intentions, as he did nothing to hinder him. In fact, now and then he used the tip of the stick to give directions from a distance as to which way to turn. If only his father would stop that unbearable hissing. It was making Gregor quite confused. When he had nearly finished turning round, still listening to that hissing, he made a mistake and turned himself back a little way that he had just come. He was pleased when he finally had his head in front of the doorway, but then he saw that it was too narrow, and his body was too broad to get through it without further difficulty. In his present mood, it obviously did not occur to his father to open the other of the doors so that Gregor would have enough space to get through. He was merely fixed on the idea that Gregor should be back into his room as quickly as possible. Nor would he have ever allowed Gregor the time to get himself upright as preparation for getting through the doorway. What he did, making more noise than ever, was to drive Gregor forwards all the harder, as if there had been nothing in the way. It sounded to Gregor as if there were now more than one father behind him. It was not a pleasant experience, and Gregor pushed himself into the doorway without regard for what might happen. One side of his body lifted itself. He lay at an angle in the doorway. One flank scraped on the white door and was painfully injured, leaving a vile brown fleck on it. Soon he was stuck fast and would not have been able to move at all by himself. The little legs along one side hung quivering in the air, while those on the other side were pressed painfully against the ground. Then his father gave him a hefty shove from behind, which released him from where he was held and sent him flying and heavily bleeding deep into his room. The door was slammed shut with a stick. Then, finally, all was quiet.
That was Franz Kafka's The Metamorphosis, Part 1, as read by our own Seth Williams. Seth Williams is the avatar for a 3-kilometer sentient starship that is parked, probably uncomfortably, close to the third planet. Surprisingly, they have not yet been discovered. They are very happy that the inhabitants have discovered enough technology to communicate, even this limited fashion. Any communications can be directed to www.thebujum.org. Thank you, Seth. That will be our show for the evening, Children of the Night. Visit our Patreon page in the links below, and don't forget to like us on Apple Podcasts. Our show was produced by our editors Scott Silk, Seth Williams, and Drew Sebastini. Website design by Josh Leitze, and theme music by Diane Severson. Tales to Terrify is distributed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 license. Join us again next week for another episode of Tales to Terrify.
This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.